Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this episode of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of the Caribbean, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the reality of the slave economy created by the Caribbean's European colonisers, as well as the process that drove its expansion and ultimately its dismantlement.
In any consideration of the history of the Caribbean, we inevitably look at the difficult topic of slavery. Difficult for us, ghastly for those people that experienced it. And as I mentioned last week, and this week should be listened to in the context of last week we looked at the origins of European slavery in the Caribbean. We drew attention to limited evidence of pre-contact, pre-European arrival slavery among indigenous people. We emphasised the extent to which coercive labour, controlled labour, was not just simply a matter of slaves from Africa. There was also the slavery of local people by the Spaniards, particularly with the gold workings in Hispaniola. We talked about convict labour being brought in from Europe. We talked about indentured workers being brought in from Europe. And we also mentioned that slavery at the expense of Africans began in the New World context. First, it really originated with the Portuguese developing a sugar slave economy in Madeira in the 15th century, then moving from that in the early 16th century into their much larger, more extensive, more new soil from the point of view of cultivation in northern Brazil around Recife and Bahia. And then from that model, and indeed it's worth bearing in mind that the single largest slave society in the New World throughout the period of slavery was Brazil. But thereafter, that being brought into the West Indies. And obviously, if we're looking at the Caribbean, we are familiar with the extent that whilst each of the countries in Europe tend to treat their slavery as the key issue, whether we were talking about the British or the French, or indeed powers that had smaller colonial presence in the Caribbean islands at any rate, and nevertheless had slaves, the Dutch, for example, or the Danes. Nevertheless, there is a commonality that we need to think about, the commonality of enslavement and the use of slaves. And also, of course, there is the commonality of the experience of being a slave. Now, in each case, there are variations. And I mentioned last time that, in fact, some slaves, and I discussed this in my book, particularly slaves that live in urban communities, often are in better working conditions, a degree of independence, a capacity for earning money, and in some cases, not typically so, but in some cases, owning slaves of their own. And obviously, we can take that further and say that, you know, slave society was hierarchical and some slaves were put in positions of authority over others. Having said all that, the fact of the matter is that slavery was not an attractive working circumstance. And there is no doubt in my mind, and I've obviously published separately a history of slavery and a history of the Atlantic slave trade, there is no doubt in my mind that although coercive labour, controlled labour, was the norm across much of the world in the early modern period, and indeed into the mid-19th century, nevertheless, slavery, and it's difficult to define, but slavery was the worst form, the most difficult form of that. And on top of that, there seems to be little doubt in my mind that slavery, when it had a racist component, when it was based on controlling, owning, exploiting people of a different colour, was particularly harsh. It doesn't mean that slavery could not be harsh between black people and black owners or between white people and white owners. Obviously, both is the case. But all I wish to say is that it was particularly harsh in the case of people of different ethnicity. Now, If we're then looking at the actual condition of slaves, which I've discussed in my several books, clearly it depended upon a whole host of factors. One of the factors was the degree of brutality, care, concern, lack of concern of slave owners. And that varied. And it's quite clear that reading correspondence, either by slave owners or about slave owners, looking at legal records about the subject, it's quite clear that there were significant variations. Second of all, the working circumstances changed. The working on some crops was harder than others. I once, in order to try and see what it was like. And of course, I was not somebody who was malnourished. I was not being beaten. I still found the process of cutting sugarcane in Antigua under a hot sun with no shade incredibly arduous. And I can't help to imagine what it must have been like if one was physically weaker and being maltreated at the same time. But it also needs to be said that some slavery was less difficult than others. So slaves who were acting as cattle ranchers, for example, in part of Saint-Dominique, particularly what becomes the eastern end of the island, Saint-Domingo, what becomes the Dominican Republic, would have had a less harsh working environment, did have a less harsh working environment than slaves operating on growing cotton. Or for that matter, for example, sugar is much harsher than tobacco in order to the physical labor involved, et cetera, et cetera. So there's partly a question of the actual nature of the work involved. Partly there's the question of the society that one is in. There was clearly support mechanisms among slaves, particularly if they came from similar areas, in Africa, and obviously spoke the same languages, and particularly if they were allowed to live in familial groups and to form familial groups. Whereas on the other hand, if slaves were essentially broken down and atomized, put together in work gangs with people from very different backgrounds, then and with no real means of communication between them, then there wasn't that form of support, and there was a much harder and harsher means of looking after themselves and coping with adversity. It's also clear from demographics of slavery that just as a percentage of slaves died on the Middle Passage, it also ought to be said, of course, a percentage of slaves died in Africa being mistreated by Africans, but we'll leave that to one side. Just as a percentage died in the Middle Passage, a significant percentage, roughly the same percentage as among the sailors, the white sailors, because the key problem was infectious disease in small crowded ships. So once one arrived in the New World, there were particular problems. Problems caused, for example, by often long journeys to places of work. That was less of an issue on the islands, more of an issue if one was being transported to the mainland. And then, of course, there were the death rates among slaves as they worked, some harsher than others. For example, Brazil as a whole, we're talking about a very large environment there, but Brazil, I think it's fair to say, being more arduous, for example, than the Leeward Islands, and so on and so forth. So you have differences in that respect. So the slave experience, one is often pushed to categorize it, varies enormously. And that leaves aside the fact that we're talking about slavery from the cusp of the 15th to the 16th century until, in the case of Brazil, the late 19th century, in the case of, say, the British colonies, the 1830s, French colonies, the 1840s, and so on. So, in other words, one's talking about a significant period of time of over 300 years, and it should not but be expected that that then led to itself difference in circumstances.
Well, Professor Black, thank you for that introduction. In your book, A Brief History of the Caribbean, you draw a number of comparisons and contrasts between European colonization in the West Indies and European colonization in the East Indies, what are now the Straits and Indonesia. I wonder if you could draw out or tease out why the slave model was so central to the development of these colonial economies in the West Indies when it wasn't in a colonial economic development in the East Indies?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, what I try to argue in my book is that in the East Indies, first of all, labour is much, much more plentiful, that the major colonial presence which is developed is by the Dutch initially in Java, and Java is populous, long populous, a rice-based society where there's plenty of food. I don't mean by that the people are necessarily comfortable, but there's plenty of food and labor is easily obtainable. One of the great problems in the Caribbean is that first, there wasn't a very significant population when the Europeans arrived. Second, that population was hit very hard by infectious disease, particularly smallpox and influenza. And I think we're possibly better able to understand this now during the age of COVID than maybe people were able to understand in the past, the speed of infection. And obviously infection was much harsher in societies where people were much more malnourished and where they had no antigens. And thirdly, the need for a labor force for activities, whether it was mining gold initially on Hispaniola or eventually for colonial plantation goods. Now, I think what's worth bearing in mind, so I try and discuss in the book, is the Spaniards to a considerable extent sweep through. Now, by that, I don't mean to say that it's like the Vandals in the 5th century moving through France and Spain en route to establish themselves in modern day Tunisia. What I mean is the Spaniards established themselves, lay claim to a number of colonies, particularly Cuba and Hispaniola, the two largest islands in the Caribbean, but also to other islands. They lay claim to the third largest island, Jamaica, for example. But then they discover far more attractive agricultural and mining possibilities on the continental mainland, particularly as we discussed last time in Mexico, but also subsequently in Peru. Now, what that means, and with plentiful supplies of native labor there. So what that means is that for Spanish ministers, entrepreneurs, landowners, it's much better to establish yourself in the Americas on the mainland. And Cuba in particular, which had initially looked, and Hispaniola as well, as though it would be a major center of activity, as it were, downturns. And at that point, the actual need for slave labor, if we're looking at, shall we say, the 1540s, 1550s, is very modest. And you'll recall that when Captain Hawkins, the English slave trader, tries to run slaves into Spanish America and has his final bust up with the Spanish authorities, it's on the coastline of modern day Mexico. Now, what I think is the case is a very different, and I think there is a role of contingency here, very different set of circumstances comes into play on the islands in the 17th, and more particularly from the late 17th century. And that is that the English, the French, and the Dutch, but particularly the first two, established themselves successfully on the islands, not on all islands, but on the islands. They do not have comparable success, or make a comparable effort, it ought to be said, to establish themselves on the continental mainland. There are some positions, obviously, the French eventually in Louisiana, the English, if we're looking at the Caribbean, in Belize and on the Mosquito Coast of what is now Nicaragua. But fundamentally, they're on the islands. What on earth are they going to do? they discover that opportunities, as with the Providence Bay Company, to try and finance themselves through licit and illegal trade, through privateering, through buccaneering, doesn't work anywhere near as well as they thought they would. But the opportunities appear to be there for plantation goods, which can then be sold back to Europe, where there is no local production or very little local production, and therefore which will be very profitable. So, you know, you've got this land. I mean, the English established themselves, say, in Jamaica in the late 1650s. You've got this land. To benefit from it, you're going to need slaves. So there is, in many senses, a demand-led process from the colonies in the Caribbean to provide slaves to them, at the same time that there are supply availability. First, that the rulers and entrepreneurs of Atlantic Africa are quite happy to enslave other Africans and are quite happy to sell them in return for goods which they wish to receive, cloth, iron, armaments, you know, being the most prominent, but by no means the only ones. And on top of that, there are merchants that establish the value of transporting goods from Europe to Africa, slaves from Africa to the New World, colonial products from the New World back to Europe, making a significant profit at each stage. Now, it's not always a profit, and as I argued, demonstrated in my work, a lot of merchants only went in for it for one voyage. They didn't receive the benefit they'd assumed. But even if at the individual level trade might be high risk, and think about in another example, not the slave trade, the Merchant of Venice and Antonio there, and in aggregate terms, it was profitable. And that profit in aggregate terms helps to produce money for the ports of Atlantic Europe, places like Liverpool and Bristol in the British Isles, Nantes, Bordeaux in France. And that in turn encourages fresh investment. Again, one has to put this in context. There is a tendency at the moment, for obvious reasons linked both to academic fashion, but also to culture wars, for people who work on the subject, or, you know, as it were, debate it, to argue that this was absolutely crucial to the development of the West. I think we have to be a little more skeptical about that. A lot of the wealth that came into Europe through transoceanic trade came in from the Indian Ocean, particularly in the case of the English India, French India, and the Dutch, what becomes Indonesia. And these are not slave labor forces, so that's point number one. Secondly, if you're looking at the Americas as a whole, the key element that produces liquidity for the European economy is not slave-grown crops, but actual bullion itself. More specifically, silver from the Spanish colonies of Mexico and Peru, and gold from the Portuguese colony of Brazil, the latter being particularly important to Britain. So one has to be very cautious about exaggerating, overestimating the role of the sugar in particular in the European economy. But having said that, it nevertheless was significant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, these large slave cash crops of tobacco, cotton, and sugar in the Caribbean, how quickly did they become the real focus of investment? What other crops were attempted and failed? And were there other attempts to diversify the economy?
Oh, yes. Other crops include indigo, for example, another slave crop, although it's more commonly on the North American mainland, is rice. Another slave crop, although it's more commonly in Venezuela, the Spanish colony there, is cacao. I mean, basically, anything. One of the ones you didn't mention, which is possibly one of the most important, was coffee, which comes in particular from Martinique and Guadeloupe. And whereas the major supply to Europe of coffee in the 16th century and at the beginning of the 17th century had been Yemeni coffee exported from Mocha on the Red Sea up through the Ottoman Empire, through Egypt, which is an Ottoman Empire possession, through across the Mediterranean and brought into, say, France at Marseille. By the mid and even more late 17th century, that's of minimal consequence, and the major flow of coffee is coming in from the French West Indies, again, into France through Marseille. So there are a number of crops. We tend to focus on sugar, partly because sugar was particularly important in the British colonies, not only in the British colonies, but particularly in the British colonies. But it's by no means the only crops. And on top of that, of course, there are the crops grown in order to feed the local population, both white, free black, which there were some of, and enslaved black.
Well, there are all these different European colonial groups taking control of islands and vying for control of the islands. You've got obviously the Spanish, the French, the English, or British as they become, or also the Dutch, the Danish, and the Swedes. Are there distinctive patterns in investment and policy that these different colonial powers pursue, or actually is it almost much of a muchness? They're all doing roughly the same thing, but in their own way.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think there is variation. So, for example, the Dutch colonies, which after all, as you may know, are still part of the Netherlands, Aruba and Curaçao, the Dutch colonies, in essence, they make their money trading with the nearby mainland of Spanish-ruled South America. They're really entrepôt. They're slave societies. There are slaves there and there are slaves working there. But it's really they make their money as entrepôt societies. As far as the bulk of the islands are concerned, the Caribbean, as I tried to discuss in my book, has very different both underlying geology and surface geology due to all sorts of factors. The extent to which there's igneous rocks in due to volcanic action, the extent and age, the age of these rocks, the extent to which they've been eroded by sediment, by the weather, and that there's been sedimentation, the nature and extent of the soil cover, and as we discussed last time, the extent to which we're talking about the leeward or the windward side of islands and the extent to which they are wet or dry. And you get in the West Indies both drought conditions and you also get conditions which are the exact opposite. So given that that's the case, success in agriculture often represented a need to learn very fast about how best to respond to particular terrains and ecosystems. And in a context where there weren't local people, or there weren't very many local people, whom you could, as it were, ask, exploit, copy. So to that extent, it's very different from the standard pattern of the European economic, as it were, activity in Asia, where the Europeans very much profited by drawing on local knowledge bases, information systems, and fitting into local economic practices and profiting from them, as with, you know, we've already mentioned the British in India, the Dutch in the East Indies. And you could argue, I mean, these are views that are contentious, but you could argue that a classic example of that is the initial stage of the slave trade, the Europeans obtaining the slaves, buying the slaves, trading for the slaves in Africa. They're actually fitting in with African power networks and African concepts. The point is, when they then bring the slaves to the New World, or when they bring other forms of labor to the New World, they then have a situation of an enormous shortage of reliable information. And it's not helped by the fact, as I discuss in my book, that they don't even understand, and this is not a criticism, but they don't even understand the nature of the diseases available locally, which will prey upon human beings. So, for example, the large number of pots that they discard in which they had processed the sugarcane becomes the place in which mosquitoes breed, and those mosquitoes then spread lethal diseases to the Europeans in particular, less so, though to a certain extent, to the slave African slaves, but less so because they've been, or many of them appear to have been more habituated to, developed a degree of immunity to these diseases already. The latter point you can debate, you can discuss how far this is affected by the length of and the nature of the Middle Passage. But they certainly, it was a classic example of the information vacuum. And in many senses, I mean, you know, yellow fever isn't really fully understood. It's the vectors of yellow fever aren't really understood till a lot of the American scientific work when they're building the Panama Canal in the beginning of the 20th century. So the Europeans, to a considerable extent, are operating blind would be the wrong word, but with limited understanding of the situation. And in doing so, they take heavy death rates among both the slaves and the Europeans, and some of their colonies are more successful than others. And there's also the issue, even with those that are successful, about soil exhaustion. Many of the crops, particularly sugar, takes, as for example maize does in modern day Britain, takes a lot of nutrients out of the soil, and the result being is that you have a degree of soil exhaustion, so that it's generally argued that to take a decade, for example, the 1780s, it's generally argued that the French are developing Haiti, Saint-Dominique, much more sugar production there, much more effectively benefiting from the nature of the soil than the British are using old established sugar plantations in places like Barbados, where much of the soil is exhausted. So I would say there isn't really a commonality of experience which helps to account for interesting differences between individual colonies owned by the same colonial power, let alone colonies owned by different colonial powers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned a moment back that the indigenous population of the West Indies was not that large. I wonder if you can say a little bit more about how the demography develops, maybe by the middle of the 18th century, the 1750s. What kind of balance or imbalance are we looking at between Africans brought in as slaves, indigenous Caribbean populations, and European plantation classes?
Right. Well, that's, again, very interesting. I mean, in essence, where the Europeans successfully established themselves in the early 16th century, there were a large dying out of the native population in the Caribbean islands. Now, the situation was different on the mainland, as I've said. There were islands, and the classic example is St. Vincent, in the 17th and 18th century, but also Trinidad in the 16th century, where the Europeans failed to establish themselves, and as a result of which there was a significant amount of local population until, in the case of St. Vincent, until the late 1790s, when there was a rebellion there, and the British, having suppressed it, deported much of the population to the western to the western islands of the Western Caribbean, and also, in fact, some to Nova Scotia. The as far as the relationship and the ratio is concerned, the slave population on top of that is larger, in part because the death rate among Europeans in the Caribbean is much greater. In fact, there was some research a few years ago, I quoted it in one of my books, which argued that if the death rate in the New World in the Caribbean among whites had been the same as the death rate in, shall we say, New York, then you would have a totally different demography in the New World to what you ended up with. Because to give you an idea, in the period between 1675 and 1740, there's between about 30 and 50,000 white migrants arrive in Jamaica. But as you will know, many of these people died very, very rapidly indeed. So you end up with a situation in which the whites, despite a large number of people going there, the whites are very much a minority. And this becomes more pronounced in the second half of the 18th century as they bring in larger numbers of slaves.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I wonder if you can just give a sense of what life was like for the colonial plantationists. The assumption is that, you know, there is a colonial house where wealthy Europeans are living lives of luxury on the backs of slaves. Is that really the picture? Is there a very clear hierarchy like that? Or are there quite a lot of Europeans there who are actually not very successful? They don't own, you know, they're workers, maybe they're even indentured laborers who are actually struggling to make a living. What happens to that category?
Well, that's very interesting. Yes, there is, just as there is social differentiation among the slaves, and to a greater extent than you or I or anybody else using the term slaves, as if it's one condition would suggest. So the same thing is true among whites. There are poor whites as there are wealthy whites, and everything in between, exactly the same as in metropolitan society and exactly the same as in colonial society on the continental mainland, whether you're talking about the Spaniards in Mexico or, for example, the British in the future United States. So there are poor whites, and you can see this very much coming to the fore when you've got the revolution in Haiti in 1791, because this leads not just to black on white violence and a certain amount of white on black violence, it also leads to violence between whites. Some of the whites looking to the revolution, which to their mind gives them greater opportunities, and some of the whites looking to the royalists. I've got here, I've looked up in my book some of the figures. You asked about slave numbers. If we look at that colony, Saint-Dominique, so we're talking about what's now Haiti. In 1687, it contained 4,500 whites and 3,500 slaves. But by 1789, when there were about 800 sugar plantations, the number were 28,000 whites, which is far more than the number of whites, for example, in Louisiana, 30,000 free blacks, and 406,000 slaves. It's been estimated that the free blacks themselves owned about 100,000 of the slaves. So you've got very major differences. Now, if you want to take that further, in that colony, and indeed in the other French island colonies, of which the most important were Guadeloupe and Martinique, only white people owning at least 25 slaves could be in the colonial assemblies, which excluded those known as the petit blanc, in other words, the small whites, or we would say the poor whites. So I think it's fair to say that there are very, very differences. Or again, I quote here George III's chum, Edward Lord Thurlow, the Lord Chancellor, who's a man that has risen through his own talents, speaking in the House of Lords in 1787 and dismissing the British colonists on the Mosquito Coast, that's the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua, in whose interests he didn't care. He quoted, a set of buccaneers merely subsisting by smuggling and hitherto uninterrupted rather by connivance than authority. Well, the Lord Chancellor is not therefore suggesting people living in ample, you know, comfort in some kind of plantation. Clearly, there were people like that. There were other people very much living on an edgy position. Again, if you look, for example, at the Spanish Caribbean, in 1800, the population of what is now Venezuela was about 800,000. About 15% were slaves working in the plantations, the percentages being even lower in Colombia, Central America, and Mexico. So the majority of the population there were either, as it were, from the pre-contact indigenous population, or they were whites.
Mm-hmm. I see. I wonder if we can talk about the slave rebellions at the end of the 18th and early part of the 19th century. Were they in the main reactions to spontaneous reactions to the barbarism and injustices that slaves experienced, or were they influenced, or to what extent were they influenced by ideas of enlightenment and liberty and revolution coming from mainland Europe?
Well, first of all, let's put it in its bigger picture, shall we? Pictures, I think, would be a fair comment. Pictures in terms of what happened and how we account for it. Let's put it in terms of big pictures. There were patterns of and episodes of slave rebellion. They are important and worthy of attention. And you can see them in two main stages. One, there were acts of rebellion, opposition on the ships in the Middle Passage, whether attempts to take over the ships or people actually just throwing themselves into the sea and drowning. And you subsequently get rebellions and in the New World, and indeed a more common form of rebellion, which is running away and seeking to often go into a community of free blacks, Maroons, who live on marginal areas like the Blue Mountains in Jamaica or the Dismal Swamp in North Carolina, and there are similar areas elsewhere. So you've got that. Now, try and contextualize this. First, rebellion is a very widespread scale activity in the world in the early modern period. We can discuss, it might be an interesting program to have at some stage to look at rebellion in the early modern and the late modern period, but without in any way lessening the significance of slave rebellion, clearly, as you will be aware, the biggest rebellions in terms of scale in the 18th century world were in the Americas. I think it's fair to say the Tupac Amaru rising in the Andes at the beginning of the 1780s, which is a rising of the indigenous native population, one or two of the leaders being looking back to lineage, Aztec lineage. And you might argue the American War of Independence, which was on a scale far greater than that you would see of the largest of the slave rebellions, which is the Haiti Rebellion of 1791. If you're looking at the world as a whole, you have got many other rebellions to consider, whether you're thinking, for example, of the very large scale peasant rising in, shall we say, China in 1644, which led to the suicide of the last Ming emperor, or whether you're thinking of things like the Pugachev Rising in the Lower Volga of serfs and Cossacks in the early 1770s. So you don't need, as you quaintly do, to assume that rebellion necessarily is a product of slavery, all right? People may call themselves slaves. Some of the American patriots argued that they were being enslaved by that vile tyrant George III. I'm being ironic there, but that's not the same thing as saying that slavery, however constituted, necessarily leads to rebellion. Okay. Now, we then are looking at what I think you're asking about, which is those rebellions specific to people that have been enslaved in New World colonies. Now, of that, there is an understandable present-day contention which affects our reading of the past. And part of this contention relates to how people valorize or don't valorize or what they call direct action in the present context. So there is an argument that slavery was, in a sense, brought to an end because of action by Black enslaved opponents, that in the particular case of the Middle Passage, that drove up the cost of slave risings drove up the cost of the Middle Passage, but more specifically, that risings in the New World, Haiti or in the British colonies in the 1820s, beginning of the 1830s, led to a situation in which there was a feeling that slavery could not be persisted in. And in other words, it was, and this is part of the argument that you see with scholars who I think of as Marxist scholars, people like Kalindi Andrews, arguing that the end of slavery was not a result of humanitarian, evangelical and other sentiments on the part of Western opinion, particularly in Britain, but was a consequence of being forced by activism from the context of the slave population. And a similar argument, as you will be aware, has been offered in debating the end of European empires between 1945 and 1976. Again, how far is that due to the policy of the metropole, and how far is that due to pressure from the imperialized population? Now, I've tried to address that in my book, and I've gone through slave rebellions, and including in my books, my histories of slavery, and I've gone through, in particular, the one in Haiti, which is interesting because the one in Haiti is the one that does lead to the failure to suppress rebellion, as the others don't. And I think it's fair to say that Haiti, which was France's largest possession in the West Indies, that Haiti rebellion weakens very much the logic of France's presence in the region and helps to encourage Napoleon to sell Louisiana to the Americans in 1803, and leads him, linked to that, to the abandonment of what has been called his Western design. So I do think in that case, you can see a significant impact on metropolitan policy from slave rebellion. not so much from the fact of slave rebellion, but from the consequences of it, what happened subsequently. I do not think you can see that so clearly in the case of Britain, and I am unconvinced by the arguments that have been made in favour of that view.
So, with particular reference to the British colonies, what did drive the process of manumission of the end of slavery in British Caribbean possessions?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, you know, I've written about that at some enormous length. Well, a whole host of things. I do think that ideological changes in Britain are very important. I don't think it's any accident that the abolition of the slave trade and then subsequently the abolition of slavery are pushed through by reforming governments as opposed to Tory governments. In other words, I do think you have to locate it in part in the politics that is going on in Britain. And the but I also think that the evangelical tendency is very important, that abolitionism is very important. I'm not convinced by the argument that it was ceasing to be profitable and that therefore people thought, well, we'll give up, because actually what's very clear is that slavery was, particularly once new technologies such as steam power and for the processing of the sugar, and also railways to move products put in, that slavery could remain economically viable, as one is to see in the Spanish colony of Cuba and indeed in the American South. So I would put it more in the political and ideological context, but listeners should be aware there are others who have offered a more economic account, economic factors, and I would urge them to look at my history of slavery and my history of the Atlantic slave trade, where I do think I've tried I think I've succeeded in offering a range of opinions, which is what one should do, as opposed to the habits that some scholars have of, as it were, engaging so clearly in modern polemic that they seem to be unwilling to suggest that there is a lack of clarity in some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Black, we will pick up in the third episode of this history of the Caribbean about the what happens after the end of slavery, the later 19th and 20th centuries. But for now, thank you, Jeremy Black, the author of A Brief History of the Caribbean.
Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.